From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, the effort to make MRI machines quieter and get better results. Later, did you notice that giant red balloon in the opening ceremonies of the Olympics last week? Well, so did writer Liam Callanan.
The official media guide said it was to represent the end of communism. There was the red communism disappearing into the ether. And I thought, well, now, wait a second. I've seen that red balloon before. And I also thought I have felt that experience before of being carried away by it.
And photographer Brian Ulrich tries to wrap his arms and his lens around a massive subject, consumerism.
It's such a powerful and such an integral part of our life that we really should think about it. We should think about it in profound ways. We should try to understand it. We should try to understand it and how it's responsible for so much.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. A few months ago, we brought you a story about making imaging machines like CT scanners more child-friendly. The issue was that the devices were so intimidating to children that it was affecting the ability of technicians to get good results. The solution was to incorporate the machines into imaginative scenes like a campground or a submarine, essentially to disguise them. But it turns out that it's not just children who are intimidated. Magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs, don't necessarily look scary to adult patients, but they do make a sound roughly like this. And that was causing problems for a significant number of patients. One leading MRI manufacturer, Waukesha-based GE Healthcare, has now developed essentially a less noisy MRI machine, one that sounds like this. Richard Hausman is president and CEO of the Magnetic Resonance Division of GE Healthcare. Robert Weisbecker is administrative director of radiology for Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare, whose Elmbrook Hospital is one of the first in the country to adopt the new technology. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
What is it about the process of a typical magnetic resonance imaging machine that generates so much noise?
Well, actually, an MRI scanner is a diagnostic tool which allows you to look into the body. And it uses a lot of technology. And one of those technologies actually is introducing some kind of vibrations typically in the system. And vibrations, as we know from the loudspeaker, are generating noise. And this can be pretty loud, like a jackhammer actually. But we need that to kind of get the images acquired.
So the vibration is a necessary part of the process itself.
Correctly. It's a mandatory part of it. But it was always annoying, actually, to the patient. So we at GE Healthcare looked at a methodology to get rid of those noises.
Well, and so when the devices first came on the market, was the philosophy simply that there's nothing to be done, that noise was a necessary evil, a trade-off for what the machines were designed to accomplish?
Well, for a long time, actually, it was a necessary evil. It was thought to be a necessary evil, to be honest, until we at GE Healthcare actually kind of had the idea to completely avoid the noise from the source by switching the gradients, as we call them, in the system in a different form, but still having the same performance as on usual MRI scan.
Yeah, you mentioned that people found the noise annoying at the very least. Let me ask, in a clinical setting, what was the upshot to that? Were patients shying away from having imaging done because they were intimidated by the process?
We at Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare have found that some of the patients, because of the noise, would shy away from the MR. Because even with the noise, one of the things that every patient who goes in the magnet, the first thing they do is put earplugs into them. So that raises their awareness of the noise level in the magnet to begin with. But particularly the patients who are coming from an MR from a headache, migraine standpoint, introducing them into an environment that is a fairly loud on and off banging noise is counterproductive to getting a quality scan, because not only is it noisy, as it goes on and off, we at times see patients flinch, and when they move, we need to start the scan over again. So it also expands the time of the exam itself.
Well, and was that the primary way that you mitigated the noise, that you made it better? You gave people earplugs?
You gave them earplugs, you gave them headphones, you gave them music to listen to, you try to talk to them and give them a heads up on when the next noise level is coming so they can prepare for it. But historically, there wasn't a lot to do.
Well, so let's scan forward, if you will, to what you're now able to do. I mean, we talked about what makes a typical MR machine make so much noise. How do you go after the noise in developing the new generation? Is it different work that's being done to generate the same results?
Actually, in the last few years, many people thought about the noise levels in MRI, and a lot of solutions were developed by damping it down to a certain extent. In most cases, also kind of compromising performance. We actually choose a completely different way by radically changing the way the whole MRI scan is acquired. You need a high-fidelity system for that, and we have that at GE Healthcare. And actually, this is a technology which can be upgraded to existing systems, which is also good for our customers because it's an option which they can additionally acquire.
So a hospital such as Elmbrook doesn't need to necessarily go out and buy an entirely new piece of imaging equipment. They would just need this add-on to do this.
Correct.
Can you walk us through, I mean, obviously this is proprietary information, but to the degree that you can talk about it, what's different? What's happening in this quieter version of the MRI machines that doesn't happen in a typical machine?
Well, typically what you do in an MRI scan, you switch on and off very quickly additional small magnetic fields. And those magnetic fields are necessary to encode, so to say, the signal which you acquire so that you exactly know where the MRI signal comes from the body, so the individual voxel. If you don't do that appropriately, you don't have an image, so you have just a mess of signal. So this switching on and off is a normal way of doing it. We developed a completely new technology where we switch it way less on and off, but still use the full performance of these additional magnetic fields which we switch on. We need the fidelity of those signals so that they stay constant for a certain period of time, but they don't switch as fast anymore. And that actually just avoids the noise from the source.
The switching on and off was one of the key things that caused this really loud noise.
This generated the vibrations, and the vibrations generated noise.
Did hospitals like Elmbrook request changes like this? I mean, was there a venue for feedback? Is that how GE finds that this is really something that patients want?
At Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare, we have, you know, conversations with GE on multiple accounts of what we're hearing from patient experiences, because when they've installed new equipment, they've come up and asked, what are you hearing from patients, good, bad? You know, how can we improve this piece of equipment? You know, and from an MR standpoint, the size of the bore was one that now is bigger than it was in the past. The weight limit on the machine was bigger than it was in the past. So kind of the third one left is kind of the noise that is the limiting factor for patients, and that was the next step that they solved. So when we were looking to buy a new magnet, we answered two of ours with the bigger bore and the higher weight limit for the patients. And the third one was the silent scan, which kind of made it an easy decision for us of where we were going from a vendor choice.
And I want to clarify, your work is with Wheaton Franciscan in its entirety. Elmbrook is the first of the hospitals to have this in place, right?
Correct.
And how long has it been in place?
It's been in place since the end of November. And since then, we've had, you know, patients obviously go through the MR. The ones who appreciate the lack of noise are the ones who have been there in the past and have come out of the scan room and asked, am I done? You know, where did the noise go? Wonder if we completed the scan. You know, they have many more questions, not understanding that the exam is done, than they would have in the past.
And this, to you, must be a good sense that you've done something right here.
Oh, yeah. We are pretty happy about the feedback and actually also the commercial feedback and success of this new silent scan technology from GE. And actually, we are the first one. Actually, it's very unique for us in GE. And I'm very happy to say also here in this radio station that this was developed here in the Milwaukee area. And we're also very happy that Wheaton Franciscan is actually the first in the Milwaukee area to have the silent scan installed.
Is this where, would you say, you know, realizing that you work specifically for GE, but would you imagine this is where the technology is going? Is this going to be a pretty common part of the MRI equation in the future?
We would think so, actually. There was the bore size, which was for a long time an issue, so we went to wider bore scanners. More patient comfort is the overall tendency. And the last thing actually was the noise. And so I think this is the way to go forward, and we're pioneering that.
What was the most challenging piece of the puzzle in getting this noise to almost essentially go away?
for the system itself, the most challenging part is the fidelity of the individual components of the system. To keep the currents, introducing this additional magnetic fields constant is key for this technology. It's not so much a fast switching, it's the more fidelity of the system, and that's the most challenging part of it.
Let me ask, to the degree that either of you can talk about this, how cost figures into the equation. Obviously, when MRIs first came on the market, these were very, very expensive machines. They are certainly more common than they used to be, but adding something to it, I would imagine, drives the cost up. Obviously, it's a concern for a hospital system, but how big a part of the picture is it for you?
Anytime we buy a new piece of equipment, there's always add-on products to it. And when we go through and evaluate, is it worth the additional dollars that it is? And when something comes along the line of a silent scan where it provides, you know, one of the things that we want to do at Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare is provide the best patient experience. If we can get that piece of equipment that will provide a better patient experience, also provide us access to some patients who in the past wouldn't have had an MR, I mean, the price point has to be fairly high for not to make sense for us to do it, and it didn't get to that degree. But in the past, there have been things that are out there that get to be cost prohibitive from the healthcare standpoint.
Well, right, and it eventually touches the patients' lives too. I mean, I would imagine if you could devise, you know, there are people that think a flu shot hurts a lot, and you could devise a flu shot that doesn't hurt, but it costs $1,000. People probably would stay away from that flu shot.
Correct.
We at GE Healthcare actually are looking really for create productivity for our customers. I mean, if I recall back, I mean, MR is now around about 30 years old. Actually, last fall, we had a celebration of 30 years of high-field MRI. If I look back, I personally started in 88 doing MRI development. And at that time, the scanners were actually less performant, definitely less comfortable, but at least the same price, if not higher price. So we as GE Healthcare try to make it more performant using new patient comfort technologies, but at a more aggressive price point. So that's basically how we try to get productivity into the system.
Are we at the point with imaging technology that we're now able to think more about patient comfort and less about getting the results?
I would say it's both. It's patient comfort and it's new applications. Think about all the degenerative disease issues like Alzheimer and Parkinson. MRI is a great non-invasive, non-radiative technology to find those little subtle things. We just do a nice, interesting cooperation with the NFL to find early signs of concussion for the football players or any kind of sports action, even the army personnel. So those are things where we work hard on new applications as well.
Well, and let me ask this, because as you say, MRI is non-radiative. There was this op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about, a couple of doctors criticizing the overuse of CT scans and the dangers of unnecessary radiation. Do you see MRI playing a larger role? Obviously, there are differences in the applications of MRI versus CT, but is this one of the answers to that equation?
I would say also in CT, we at GE Healthcare, we are pushing a lot the low-dose aspects of CT as well. So this is actually going to the right direction, and there are real worlds about between the older technologies in CT and today's technology. So I would say CT is advancing also very much. Overall, we see from the MRI business globally and also in the United States actually more usage of MRI.
Rob Weisbecker, are you in Wheaton Franciscan sensitive to that issue of overuse of CT or other imaging?
Right. I mean, we monitor, you know, how much imaging we're using by physician at times. We want to make sure that we're doing the appropriate scan for the right reason at the right time, and continuing evaluating what our dose strategy is, and also balancing are they in the right modality when they're having an imaging test done. And that's something that you'll see over the next couple of years will continue to become more and more important as the technology gets better for reducing dose, and also the technology gets better for us to monitor patients' dose and provide them what dose they're getting for each exam that they get.
Where is MRI going beyond this? Imaging is better than it's been. The noises now can be less of a concern than it has been. What are the hurdles yet to clear in MR?
What we are doing at GE Healthcare is actually pushing the envelope in spreading MRI as a technology globally much more than it was in the past. I mean, we have now under development solutions for emerging markets. We have solutions for very interesting solutions for newborns, for early borns, for solutions putting the MRI into the NICU itself so that you don't have to transport the babies in the hospital. So what we want to create is reach for MRI as a technology globally as well as to new patient groups.
Well, very good. Richard Hausman and Rob Weisbecker, thank you both so much. Much appreciated.
Thank you for the time.
Thanks for the time. You're welcome.
Richard Hausman is president and CEO of the Magnetic Resonance Division of GE Healthcare. Robert Weisbecker is administrative director of radiology for Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare. There's a link to more about GE's silent scan technology from WUWM.com/lake effect. A quick break now, and then writer Liam Callanan explains why red balloons are on his mind and seemingly everywhere. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The 17th Annual Festival of Films in French is going on at UW-Milwaukee through Sunday. The festival features recent French-language films such as Paris, Manhattan, and French Immersion, and classics including the 1936 film La Grande Illusion and 1918's Jacques. But it's a different French classic not showing this year that's on the mind of Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan. The Red Balloon came out in 1956. It's about a young boy who follows a mysterious and yet charismatic red balloon through a Paris neighborhood. Callanan published a recent essay on the real-life journey of the Red Balloon's director in the online magazine Medium, and he's with us now to share a bit of the backstory. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So we're talking about red balloons here. And as you were saying before we turn the microphones on, once you start thinking about red balloons, they are everywhere. But most recently, they were very obvious in the opening ceremonies of the Sochi Winter Olympics. There was a red balloon that was released. What got you thinking about red balloons? I assume the essay that we're talking about had been long in the works before the opening ceremonies came along.
It had been. It had been. And I should point out that the Russians did not consult me before the opening ceremonies, which their error, not mine. But it's my international portfolio increases with each passing month, and I guess this is another example of that. And I was actually quite taken with the opening ceremonies overall, but particularly that image of which involved a little girl who's kind of borne aloft by this red balloon. And the official media guide said it was to represent the end of communism. There was the red communism disappearing into the ether. And I thought, well, now wait a second, I've seen that red balloon before, and I also thought I have felt that experience before of being carried away by it. And this started, so a couple of years ago, I traveled to Paris and I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal about walking in the footsteps of different children's books in Paris, Hugo Cabret, the various Madeleine books, and then I briefly touched on The Red Balloon, which was actually a film before it was a book, but mid-1950s Paris, it was a very, very striking document. It was a boy following a very, very large, bright red balloon around a fairly gray and dingy Paris, and it's a short 34-minute film. Went on to win an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, even though there's hardly more than a dozen lines. And so in any case, I wrote up this article, and I touched on it briefly, just a couple paragraphs, but then this balloon kept going, and I thought, there's more to this story. And then as I looked into it, indeed, there was. And so now I have a new essay, which is up on Medium, and it explores the path of that red balloon in some ways after it left Paris, because he turned out to be a fascinating, fascinating guy, the director.
Well, and to go back to the original movie and then book, the Red Balloon was highly symbolic, and it wasn't an especially happy movie. This was essentially a movie that got into the problems of kind of being different or thinking differently.
Absolutely. And it got into the problems of kind of a notion of hope, which I think made a lot of sense in what was still a very fresh post-war Paris. Other people have detected real Christian themes in the film. And in a more modern context, it really talks a lot about bullying. This boy and his coveted red balloon are chased all over Paris. And I think also relevant for me, it talked a lot about, you know, what is it like when something sticks to you in the story or in the film, it's that balloon sticks to the boy. But I found that the story I couldn't shake either. That's because this director, Albert Lamorisse, it was his son that was in the film, Pascal. And although he went on to do a variety of different things, he was never quite as successful as he was in that first film. And I just was so struck that he then later made a full-length feature film narrated by Jack Lemmon. It was called Stowaway in the Sky, which I think if Pixar's up, they may have wanted to look into this because it involves a grandfather and a young boy kind of being borne aloft by quite a few balloons. But when I kept kind of looking, I said, well, what an amazing story. What else did he go on to do? Well, he in fact did another final aerial film in which, of all places, Iran. So it's the late 1960s. And the Shah of Iran is looking for ways to make people think that the country has become a more modern place. And so he's talking with all sorts of filmmakers around the world, including Orson Welles, who even had a deal with the Shah to put together a film there. And he settles on Albert Lamorisse, and Albert says, fantastic. And he does this film based on the wind, which involves, again, flying all over Iran in this helicopter to see all these different places and to really kind of capture Iran for the eyes of the modern world.
This was not what the Shah had in mind, though.
Not so much. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film. It's called The Lover's Wind. You can see it on YouTube. It's also linked to from the article. It's gorgeous. It's narrated by the wind, and I don't mean that poetically, or maybe I do, but because the wind is actually a character in the film that talks. And so it has long, lingering shots of these amazing moonscapes. I mean, for someone whose only images, and I would include myself in this, is of Iran is hostages bound in an overrun U.S. embassy. This was an amazing view of just a gorgeous, gorgeous country. But no, the Shah wanted computers. The Shah wanted
science.
He wanted beakers and test tubes and people in white coats. And he definitely wanted this hydroelectric marvel, which was a dam just north of Tehran. So
it sounds like what he really wanted was one of those industrial films talking up a corporation.
Exactly. That's exactly what he wanted. And so when Lamorisse turned in this film, The Lover's Wind, the Shah was like, that's not it at all. You need to go back and you need to film this other stuff and you need to put it into the film and you definitely need to get that dam. And Lamorisse was saying, no, that's – in fact, the dam was one of the worst places to film because it's surrounded by power lines, and he knew enough about, I guess, balloons getting caught in things that he knew that he would probably get caught in that. And the Shah said, don't worry about it. In fact, I will give you my own personal helicopter pilot – and he will fly you around the dam to take shots. So they did this for a little while, and then, sure enough, it got caught up in the power lines, and they crashed. And the family, Pascal and Lamorisse's wife, were not there, and they were devastated by this. They were apparently compensated for the loss, but they were overcome with the fact that not only had their father and husband died, but also the film was never seen because the Shah hated it so much. So 8 years later, the wife and Pascal, once again, he'd gone from holding a balloon to now editing a picture. They actually edited The Lover's Wind according to Dad's notes and put together this film that was so extraordinary. It actually, about 40 days after the Shah fled Iran, was nominated for an Academy Award. So it's a very striking document. But what struck me even more was when, with some forensic internet searching, I found this even more extraordinary film, which is only 7 minutes long, which is basically a series of clips that puts everything that the Shah wanted into one seven-minute document. And it appears to have been made by Lamorisse's Iranian crew, who also felt very bereft at the loss. And they put together this tiny little seven-minute film, and it's got everything. It's got beakers, and it's got test tubes, and it's got students walking around with calculators and books, and it has shots of that dam. And ever receding, the film is always pulling back away from the dam. And they put the dam at the very end of the clip as though they wanted the Shah to kind of feel worse and worse about it. But I guess what struck me most about that film and when I really knew that I had something to write this essay about is like 2.5 minutes in, this guy in a lab coat, he's like pouring something, it looks like really thin blood or Kool-Aid into a test tube. And then apropos of nothing, he ties a red balloon to the top of this giant glass stack and it starts to inflate. And I thought, someone put this together with an artist's eye.
And so it started with kind of a flip comment that once you start seeing red balloons, you see them everywhere. But in some ways, it seems like there is something more to the idea of seeing red balloons everywhere, that it's not just that you're seeing the image, but the point of the red balloon is recurrent in a lot of places.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the other things that I was so struck by, because I was looking I was not able to make it to the Shaw's Dam in order to report on the story, but I was able, with the help of the internet and image search, to find some modern day pictures of it. And sure enough, the power lines around the dam had these giant red balls attached to them, which I know are not unique to that area, to warm pilots. But wow, they really look like red balloons. But like you say, I don't think it's so much that we're looking for those red, although you realize the brilliance of his choice in retrospect, because you really do notice red circles everywhere. But this notion of hope and a kind of an elegy for what's lost. I think one of the bravest things about that red balloon, spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it, is the way it lies crumpled on the ground at the very end. And there's another spoiler. There's a soaring moment where then Pascal takes off into the skies with hundreds of balloons of all these different colors. And I always felt that that moment at the very end of the film actually did feel a little bit tacked on or cheap, because to me it was that moment, that notion of loss and what you've lost and kind of what the arc of a life can be, and that it always ends a little bit too soon. And that certainly seems to be the case in the case of this director, who 35 years ago, as we were waiting to hear the news of the Academy Awards this season, would missed out on hearing news of his nomination.
Certainly a lot different than trying to cast Madeline books in these same ways.
Absolutely. I mean, those are children's. Again, these books were meant for kids and adults. But in the case of the Madeline books, those books are all fun. I mean, even when she plunges into the River Seine, she gets scooped out. Things are going to be okay. But in the case of the Red Balloon, even though we end on that feeling of hope, there's still this notion of elegy and loss, like what is being lost. And I think in some ways that's kind of an interesting comment on the film too, because the neighborhood in which the film was shot has also been lost, as I talk about in the essay. It was in a slum clearance program, mostly disappeared, and now is a fairly pretty terraced green park. But you lose all those kind of little winding roads, and it's a lot harder to tie a balloon to a lamppost when it's missing, which sounds like a euphemism.
It does. I was just going to say, and on that note, Liam, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Novelist and UWM English professor Liam Callanan's essay, In Paris, Tracing the Path of the Red Balloon, is published in the online literary magazine Medium. There's a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and in just a moment, a major photography exhibit at the Hagerty Museum leads us to think about our roles as consumers. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Marquette University's Hagerty Museum of Art is host to a major exhibit of photography that makes us look at and question what it means to be a consumer. For 10 years, American photographer Brian Ulrich traveled around the United States to document Americans shopping. The exhibit is focused on three chapters: retail stores, thrift shops, and dark or closed stores. Ulrich is based in Virginia now, but started the project as a graduate student at Columbia College in Chicago in 2001. He tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North what started him on this path.
It was a number of things, but most of all, I started graduate school in Chicago at Columbia College in 2001, and our first day of graduate school was September 11th. And that whole event, of course, had such an impact on us, the culture, the world. You know, there's kind of before and after as a result. But it had this really big impact on me as a person, as an artist. And I had previously been doing kind of autobiographical work. And I realized right then and there that I kind of really wanted to explore the culture and the world and look at this moment and look at how people were dealing with it. You know, there was this amazing kind of grieving process that was happening where people, the whole kind of societal norms and cultural rules were broken down, and people were really kind of comforting each other. And it was mostly because, you know, this is what happened when tragedy happens. But here it happened to the whole culture and the whole country. And so people were pulling together in these amazing and beautiful ways. And I was really just in the beginning trying to photograph that, ironically enough. I was trying to make pictures of that happening kind of naturally. So I started making photographs out on the street and in public places where, you know, those kind of moments or those kind of relationships between peoples might come together. And when I started to figure out ways to do that or some strategies to do that, all of a sudden the kind of messaging that was happening or the conversation about this post kind of 9/11 grieving changed pretty radically, and it started changing into this messaging about kind of fear, you know, about like this can happen again. We're all of a sudden extremely unsafe. We should be worried. We have to do things to prepare. And one of these ways in which people talked about preparing was to, you know, and originally it was Giuliani, and later it was Dick Cheney and President Bush and a number of other politicians who came out and basically started asking citizens to go out and shop. And of course, they were really worried about the economic hit that was going to happen to the country, but also this idea of kind of back to normal. I thought that was very, very kind of weird and interesting and powerful and complex and problematic.
Do you remember how quickly that happened, that changed from that sort of communal grieving to go out and buy?
It happened pretty quickly. Those first kind of sentiments started coming, the kind of like worry stuff. Was really kind of October. That kind of idea of economics, right, that was also really soon after where Giuliani was kind of saying, like, you know, we need to go about our regular lives. And in that context, of course, it made a lot of sense. But that kind of meme or idea was picked up on and continued up into 2002 when people were kind of talking about this idea and, like, economically what we needed to do and how we need to reinforce ourselves. And, you know, I just thought that was really interesting in the history of wars and the history of our country and the history of people and man, where this idea of money being all of a sudden the kind of protecting thing and the thing that is so connected to what will make it okay. I really just initially wanted to see if people were doing that. Like, would people follow this directive to go out and kind of patriotic shop? Was shopping now like patriotic? Was it like Cheerios were like red, white, and blue? And I answered that question pretty quickly, which was, yeah, people were. People did go out. And there was this kind of idea that, you know, this was a way in which people felt like they could, of course, participate and contribute and be a part of supporting our country, which is, of course, a very important thing. But within that, within trying to make some pictures of that, it again dawned on me that what I was starting to look at was something that was much, much bigger, that was really only could happen now, really was the dawn of the 21st century, and was ideas that had been set in motion decades earlier. And it was kind of a daunting feeling, but it was also a very exciting thing, which was I had to kind of get to work and figure out a way to do this. So initially that idea manifested itself in really looking at middle class experience of this and middle class relationship to consumerism. And that is in this kind of chapter of this larger Copia project, and it's called Retail, pretty simply.
There are three parts to this. The first one is retail, then you have thrift, and then you have the dark store, sort of the very end of consumerism before it kind of gets recycled into something else. Did you start out with those in mind, or did those evolve as you progressed in the initial photographs?
You know, what was, again, at times daunting and in other ways many very liberating was the idea that I wasn't necessarily in a hurry to do this project, that it didn't have a deadline, that it didn't have to have a completion date. Really, it was about trying to figure out ways to make the next picture. And with that came a lot of research, too. And those two things working tandem started to take me to places that, of course, were kind of outside of what I had already thought or knew or expected. So I didn't really plan to do thrift. In fact, I remember bringing that idea up early on to some professors, and they were like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. That's just too much more work, you know? It's like a whole other amount of traveling and things that has to happen. But then in 2005, Hurricane Katrina happened, and all of a sudden it really seemed like a very succinct moment where the broadcast of such a large problem in this country, which is poverty and race, was broadcast on primetime TV, like 24-hour news, like over and over and over. And I started thinking about, like, well, wouldn't thrift then be the great way to talk about that? And again, not necessarily in the kind of obvious way of we buy and make too many things, but all the other parts, which are based around the tradition of these kind of resale shops and thrift stores being community organizations that are there in service to the community. And of course, in more recent times, poor people or people, you know, who economically have to, you know, shop in those places. So that became a whole other investigation. And it also asked me to make pictures in different ways than I had before.
And you're talking about the actual taking of the photographs, mm-hmm. in that sense? Okay. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to get to Dark.
Yeah. The full title of that project is actually called Dark Stores, Ghost Boxes, and Dead Malls. And those terms are taken from the actual retail, especially retail real estate and commercial real estate industry uses those terms to describe specific spaces. They mean very specific things. You know, a dark store can be a store that's kind of laid dormant, but is maybe closed, but may come back. It's in this kind of like limbo place. A ghost box is like a store in which it's not coming back, and it's kind of the ghost of its former thing. And and how amazing that these terms were invented. And of course, the dead mall represents, you know, the mall which is either failing or gone, and what to do with those things. So in 2005, I actually thought that would be the next project. But it was really came out of, I lived in Chicago at the time, and I used to drive past this large closed grocery store at night. And when I was driving past it at night, it looked specifically like a kind of Rothko painting. You know, I mean, there was the kind of gorgeous Chicago light pollution that is always happening, where you can never see the night sky and it's always some color, you know, this kind of hulking square rectangle box that had been kind of painted and plywood covered on the front. And then the glimmering kind of night sky on the parking lot that was really divided into these three distinct forms, which I kind of thought, well, I have to try and see if it's possible to make a photograph that did what I think I'm seeing. So I went out one night and made a few pictures like that. And, you know, they were kind of almost there. But I immediately had this hard problem, which was like, how am I going to find more of those spaces? You know, how do you find all that stuff? And it was quite difficult because they weren't as predominant at the time. But I also remember writing early on that, like, that idea that this kind of model of always growth was really problematic, that for kind of retail business to always succeed, it had to always grow. And of course, there would be an inevitable conclusion to that, which would be that it would eventually have to recede, even in the idea that, like, nobody seemed to have seen that coming. It seems so obvious to me. So when 2007, late 2007 and early 2008, the dialogue started happening around that, it seemed really obvious, and that seemed like the time to do that project, and it was. And I kind of made some pictures in earnest in May of 2008, and it was that, you know, those kind of moments where you know exactly what you need to do.
I find looking at the ones of the dark stores, you know, the ghost stores, it's very sad to see a building that was a house that people no longer live in, that's abandoned. There's something very, very sort of aching and sad, right, about that. there's a different feeling about the box stores, because nobody ever lived in them, but there was a certain kind of life mm-hmm. that was there that is no more, and I don't know exactly what that feeling is. It's not, you're not mourning a family, Louise, but something's missing.
Yeah, I think the I really specifically, again, and even in the initial research, I came across those terms. Those terms were so kind of drippingly romantic that I thought it was really important to try to make the pictures as, like, drippingly romantic. Because they're very dumb spaces, in a sense. You know, we drive past them all the time. They're around us. They're outside the car window. And they're meant not to be looked at, which, of course, I find really interesting to make them this kind of specific subject of the photograph. So I would do all these things. That's why most of them were made at night. I would make these really long exposures, painting with flashlights. I got a police light that attached to the cigarette lighter on the car that reached really far, and I could kind of like expose the image over time. But I wanted that to do that because, again, the trick was to, how do you get people to pay attention to this thing which is in our periphery? How do you get people to think about this subject which is big, which is encompassing, and which is representative of so much? I've had shows of that work and some of this work in Europe a few times, in Germany, and it's amazing how foreign the whole idea of much of this is. You know, like, they don't... I mean, I spent about half an hour trying to explain to a group of Germans what mall walking was, which was quite a hilarious and confusing and gratifying moment all at the same time. But the idea that there would be this much expansion and growth and building and investment and all this, and that it would be kind of left to literally kind of disintegrate back into the earth, was just so wild when you think about it.
Now, to just sort of sum up for you as the artist and the person doing all of this examination mm-hmm. and exploration, have you changed your ideas about what material things mean, what consumerism means? Has it shifted over the last 10 years, or are you finding that the work you're doing is sort of reinforcing what you already suspected was there?
No, I think the one of the great things about, you know, it's in a sense, you know, it's, of course, it's not easy to be an artist, and it, of course, at times looks a lot more glamorous than it really is. But it is a real luxury to be able to work out an idea, a very kind of abstract thing that at times, as it's kind of being put together brick by brick, is hard to kind of even fathom, especially for other people. But the great part of that is that it teaches you, you know, and the project kind of leads you in all these interesting directions. So I can't ever be the same person after talking to some of the security guards whose jobs are basically inevitably over, who are guarding the dead mall in the parking lot at 2 a.m., or the cops who would come by to ask me what the hell I was doing. I can see how afraid they are to do their job. You can see the fear in them, and they're like, what are you doing? You realize where you are, you know? And so it's profound. I mean, you come into contact with so much of the way that people are living their lives, that, of course, it asks me to live differently. It asks me to redefine ideas of success. It asks me to redefine ideas of what I certainly need or want.
Do you find yourself less attached to things?
Yeah, in many respects. Like, so much of the kind of things, quote-unquote, that I have are built around making the work, you know? And that's work. And sometimes I would love to have it all gone because it's responsibility. You know, if I move, I have to move all this stuff. Even all the things that I collected, they're kind of can be a thorn in my side. But, you know, the other thing that's happened too is that I've also come to understand something else, which is there is something to an object and there is something to craft, right? I mean, I'm an artist. I believe in craft. I work really, really hard to make photographs that function beautifully and as objects. And what that teaches me is that there is something really profound in that. There is something really profound in things that were made by hands and touched and so on. What that can mean and what it had meant earlier in our history and what it means now and how some of that may have been lost and how some of it can be gained back. I don't think it's a coincidence that, things, websites like Etsy are really, really popular and how people want unique crafted items that come almost directly or directly from the person who made the thing. That's a really, really powerful thing.
Well, Brian Ulrich, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with the exhibition.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
The exhibit, Brian Ulrich, Copia, Retail, Thrift, and Dark Stores, 2001 to 2011, is on display at the Hagerty Museum of Art through mid-May. Ulrich spoke with Bonnie North. The project is ongoing, and at wuwm.com/lakeeffect, Ulrich talks about where his work might go next. One last break, and then an essayist revels in the silence of a spiritual retreat. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Winter tends to drive all of us inside our houses and probably inside our heads as well. But many of us tend to distract ourselves with the internet or TV or our movie collection. But for Lake Effect essayist Richard Hederman, it's the longitudes of silence that are exactly what he's looking for.
Sprawling across an open hilltop and surrounded by 1,800 acres of woodlands and fields outside Spencer, Massachusetts, very nearly the exact geographic center of the state, is St. Joseph's Abbey, a complex of fieldstone buildings comprising a monastery with a chapel, bell tower, cloister and retreat house, and approximately 80 Trappist monks. It is deeply rooted in their tradition for Trappists to offer refuge to travelers, and each year I return and spend a week with them in January, the true geographic center of winter. The Trappists are a Catholic religious community of cloistered monastics, a branch of the Benedictines formerly known as the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. Deeply contemplative by rule and by practice, the order has emerged over the centuries as the standard for Western monasticism. St. Joseph's was settled in 1950 by a group of Belgian and French monks from Nova Scotia and Rhode Island. In these rustic hills of central Massachusetts, the monks cleared the land and built their monastery themselves by hand with the guidance of local contractors. Trappists rigorously follow a way of life that is at once faithful to the archaic traditions of the order and likewise adaptive to modern life. Though cloistered, the monks of St. Joseph's keep up with the news. They read the papers, listen to the radio, and many of them have email accounts. At least some among them appear to be sports fans. I once saw an elderly monk removing a Yankees cap before donning his robes for Vespers, and this in Red Sox country. Historically, most of my fellow retreatants at St. Joseph's have been clerics of one class or another, priests and monsignors, and once by some odd chance, a Baptist preacher from North Carolina. Above all, I'm there for the silence. And I imagine the devout regarding me with suspicion as I bundle out the door in hiking boots for my morning hike down the hill to the main road and back, or spend an evening in the retreat house parlor under a lamp with my feet up reading a murder mystery. Except for meals, one's time at the Abbey is almost entirely unstructured. There are essentially only two rules: don't make any noise, and never tread unaccompanied into the monastic enclosure, that part of the monastery and its grounds forbidden to guests. Securing permission for a foray alone into the monastic enclosure is nearly impossible unless you can confirm absolutely that you are retreating from a grass fire. After the midday meal, the broad, revenant swell of afternoon is before us. One drifts wordlessly across the longitudes of silence. The retreat house and its inhabitants fall into a tranquil, contemplative torpor. As I quietly read in the deep afternoon light or invite sleep, the sky above our hilltop often stages dramatic expositions of weather. Winter winds rarely blow gently here, but howl, hammering windows and rooftops and roaring like the breath of God shoved through a needle. Gusts of heavy rain or billowing snow and violent lashings of wind scour the hilltop, hurling enormous volumes of towering cloud. In the spellbound dusks, veils of snow unfurl and lay upon the hills like a leaf from the gospel. At 5:30 each evening, a brother leads us to Vespers, a word sounding deliciously like whispers, and deriving from the Latin for evening. We follow a winding path through the monastery complex, down a labyrinth of passageways, padding solemnly over polished stone floors, gleaming softly in the medieval light. There are vistas through a series of soaring arched windows of an inner courtyard deep in snow, and snowbound statues of the Virgin and others too rimed with ice to recognize. Contrary to common belief, it is Compline and not Vespers that is the final service of the monastic day. The word Compline derives from the Latin root meaning complete, and of all the services in the divine office, it is my favorite. The chapel is dimmed to the light of a single candle suspended from the nave. Monks in pale robes chant. The chapel is submerged in unbroken shadow, consuming the fires of day and assuaging the soul of the mystic, the penitent, and the uncertain. One night, as I lay drifting off, a pack of coyotes yipped and howled somewhere beyond the walls of the retreat house as they ranged the moonlit fields in utter disregard of the monastic enclosure. So feral and unrestrained was their exclamation that hair rose on the back of my neck, and I dared not look out. For what I heard had in it something beyond us, a savage lament for the undefined terrain of the spirit, or perhaps just some primal salute to the unknowable.
Poet and essayist Richard Hederman lives in Wauwatosa, and while he hopes to return to St. Joseph's Abbey sometime soon, this January he listened for the feral and unrestrained howl of winter from the solitude of his study, and his essay first aired then. And with that, we close another week's worth of Lake Effects. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Craig Wirrell. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Have yourself a terrific winter weekend, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.